Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan. And if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started. Okay, welcome back, Kaylee.
The last time we talked about your dissertation work on victim offense mediation, or VOM, and there was so much in your dissertation, and we really focused last time on how you got into that topic and the positive outcomes that people often experience and what that looked like in your dissertation and the differences particularly between, you know, cases with proxies and cases without. And, you know, this time I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about one of your main findings about the relationship that develops between victims and offenders. But I was wondering first, like, your dissertation, the final document, included a lot of discussion about the idea of colonial appropriation of restorative justice. And so I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit as we're getting started.
Sure. Yeah, we'll just start with the heaviest topic. Sure. Yeah, I did a lot of thinking. So one of the byproducts of having a dissertation that took me so long to do is that I was so much better educated about cultural appropriation at the end of it than I was at the beginning of it. So I had started to notice things that had not even occurred to me before, which is a privilege that they hadn't. Things like, we really repackaged Indigenous justice practices and took credit for them and called them this like newfangled thing called restorative justice and patted ourselves on the back for it and then applied it to the forensic populations in North America. And a lot of that population is Indigenous. So it really feels like we are using their own practices, but calling them our own. This is an overused term, but it feels very gaslighty. It's plagiarism in my mind, that unless you give credit to the roots and the origins of those practices, you're plagiarizing. They're not original ideas. They came from somewhere and they happen to come from Indigenous groups. So it felt like a slap in the face to those groups not to acknowledge that that's where it came from and that it is now being integrated into the colonial system. And some of the articles that I read would argue that it's really being bastardized. And one of the terms often used is watered down. When you try to make restorative practices fit into a retributive system, they by nature have to be watered down in order to fit in. So I did a lot of grappling with the issue of, okay, what do we have here? Do we have two separate systems? Do we have one integrated system? Are we fighting to replace the colonial system with the Indigenous system? What are we doing? I didn't come up with an answer. So what I ended up doing was having a section in my document where I talk about as many arguments as I could find in the literature, and I just laid it all out. And I still don't know where the real answer is, and I think that it's also not for me to say, because I'm personally not Indigenous. And I would love for research to be done about how Indigenous people feel about this practice of taking Indigenous justice, calling it restorative justice, and patting themselves on the back for, hey, we're good white people coming up with this more culturally appropriate practice when really it's appropriated.
I'm just curious because, you know, for your dissertation, you completed the mediator training. You know, this is not a world that I'm very familiar with. My assumption, though, and it is an assumption, just based on what I know of colonialism in Canada, is that people might not be made aware that this is something that is appropriated. Was there anything in the mediator training to that effect? Or is this kind of being shared with, like, without that context?
Yeah, there is none whatsoever. Granted, I took the training in the States and it was, I would say 12 years ago now. I would like to believe that awareness about cultural appropriation has progressed a little bit. And maybe it would be different in Canada versus the US. I'm not sure, but I can say for sure that it was never mentioned. And often in literature, even in studies that are being published in Canada now, whenever there's, you know, the requisite paragraph about the origins of restorative justice, it 9 times out of 10 gives credit to the PO in Ontario who came up with this idea, who, I mean, I'm super glad he had that idea and it started a movement that I think is important. But I also think it's important to recognize he got that idea from somewhere.
True origin story.
Exactly.
So I wanted to talk specifically in this episode about your findings around corrective emotional experiences.
Yeah.
And that's a very jargony term that we throw around in our discipline of clinical psychology quite easily. So would you take a little bit of time to explain to those who might not be familiar with a corrective emotional experience, like what it is, who first spoke about it, what settings we would expect it in our discipline?
Sure. So it's a term that came from the psychodynamic, psychoanalytic world, but it has really proliferated. If you've ever been one of my private practice clients, I have definitely shoved this term down your throat at some point. It's probably my favorite because to me, and I will define it in a minute, but to me, it describes how and why therapy can work. And that's how it was intended. It was used to describe something that happens in therapy. But I also think, and I argue in my dissertation, that it can explain things that happen outside of therapy as well. And so what a corrective emotional experience is it's an outcome that challenges your assumptions, and your assumptions are based on what you've experienced before. So, for instance, if I am from a family where my opinion wasn't valued, or what I needed wasn't valued, I'm going to grow into an adult likely who doesn't value my own feelings, needs, thoughts. And then I meet somebody who values what I want and asks me what I need and provides me with things that I need, even if I don't realize I need them. There's going to be some tension there. It's going to feel uncomfortable because it's different than what I have gotten before. It's different than what I'm expecting, but it's also going to provide me with the corrective emotional experience. You start overwriting what you had before. And that is, in a nutshell, what a corrective emotional experience is. Yeah, in my view, that's how therapy works. You build a relationship with your therapist that is different than what you have in other areas of your life. And in my study, I think that it explains why some of the offenders hooked in.
Yeah. So I was just going to leave there myself too. You know, so this is a concept that's been around a long time in psychotherapy, you know, and it's one of the things that we hope the therapeutic relationship will do and that will translate into someone's life outside of therapy. But your participants, both victims and offenders, from what I recall, had some corrective emotional experiences. So can you share with people who are listening a little bit more about what that looked like for some of the participants? And also, like, what are the implications of that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the victims they're simpler to explain with this concept. So I'll start there. If the victim came into the room feeling like the young offender wasn't going to show much remorse, wasn't going to feel sorry for what they did, wasn't going to own up to it, wasn't going to value making up for it. And then they sat down with an offender who apologized and said, "What can I do to make up for this? I'm so sorry. I didn't realize the impact it was going to have on you." Then the victim has to sort of reorganize their schema in their brain and assimilate that information and go, "Wait a minute. Okay, so maybe not all young offenders are like this. Maybe he or she is feeling remorse. Maybe that is valuable to them." And then the implication is that then in the future, they might treat similar young people differently because they now have some data that they can pull on that challenges their default assumption. For offenders, so let's talk about one offender that came and really wasn't very engaged, just wanted to get it over with without a criminal record. That was really the only motivation. Like, I'm here because my lawyer told me to be. This individual was used to, I mean, it was their first official criminal charge, but they had been, you know, written up for truancy at school. They had been, you know, yelled at by parents and grandparents and guardians, and were just sort of, they viewed themselves as like a bad kid because that's what they'd heard repeatedly. And of course, we all know about stereotype threat, and we tend to perform at the level that people are expecting of us. And so the bar was set pretty low for this individual. He expected just more of the same, to be lectured. And instead, he came and the victim was very open and had expressed that she had already forgiven him before she came into the room. And she said, like, I'm interested in knowing what was going on for you at the time. And there was no detectable anger transmitted from the victim to the offender. And he shared with me later that that was really surprising for him. He was confused at first. And then he realized, oh, this woman really just wants to help me get better. And like, she really believes, I think his exact words were, she seemed like she believed I could do better in the future. And that made such an impact for him because no one had communicated that to him before. So it was vastly different than what he anticipated, what he expected, and what he thought of himself. And he said that that had such an impact that it was going to change his behavior in the future. That kid now be in his 20s. I don't know what he's up to, but I hope that that's true.
I think it's important to also just remind the people listening, and this is part of why I'm so thrilled about this finding, is that these are also young offenders, right? You know, these are youth who are at a stage where developmentally, you know, a corrective emotional experience might arguably be more impactful, you know, than it could be, particularly when we're looking at restorative justice as a means of reducing reoffending or offending future, right? And that's what I think makes me so excited about your finding.
Me too, because developmentally, there is no reason to suggest, there's no reason to assume that these offenders would need to keep being in the justice system in the future. They are at a point in their life where studies suggest they are capable of going down a different path later. And so I think that it's those decisions that are made in that developmental stage are important because maybe for some of these youth, they're at a fork in the road where they can either choose to keep offending and end up in the adult system, or they can go, wait a minute, someone else thought I could do better. Maybe I'll try that. And, you know, whenever you get going down that path, momentum builds, the better you get at pro-social activities. So yeah, I'm really happy that the program exists and that it seems to be working.
So your dissertation is some of the first evidence that at least you and I found of a corrective emotional experience occurring outside of psychotherapy. If we can promote corrective emotional experiences for or in VOM, what are the implications for VOM and restorative justice?
I think that, I mean, the corrective emotional experience to me, like I still get goosebumps thinking about it. I'm such a nerd. I'm so happy that it existed, that it happened in VOM because, like, if we talk in the States, it's called the Department of Corrections. That's corrective, you know, like we finally found something that actually corrects something. That is what forensic psychology is supposed to be aiming to do. You know, we don't just want to house individuals or punish them. We want to figure out how do we get you going down a different path? And I think the answer to that, at least in part, is providing a corrective emotional experience. And it sounds like a little woo-woo, But I was really happy to like, now I can say, no, that's what my actual research suggests, that you really just need somebody to believe that you can do better, to give you a chance of doing better.
I don't know what the answer to this question is, full disclosure. I'm not setting up for an answer I'm expecting, because I don't know. Do you think it's possible to have a corrective emotional experience that doesn't occur relationally? You know, like not in the context of particular, like let's say as well, you know, maybe through other more traditional approaches to justice. I think in the psychotherapy literature, you know, if we had to rely on what we know about corrective emotional experiences, that's a personal process. And if we're going to extrapolate from clinical psychology, we would not expect that to happen outside the context of VOM.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. Well, I would imagine they can happen. Like I was thinking, well, they happen with animals, but that's relational. And then I was thinking, okay, what if I think I'm really bad at something and then I try it and I'm better at it than I think I am? That could be called a corrective emotional experience, but I would think that getting the motivation to try it on my own, if we trace that back, it probably goes back to something relational. So
it's,
I don't know.
It's like part jargon that's beyond this episode, but gives me something I want to look into now.
Yeah. I don't know.
I also think when we think about applying findings, right? And, you know, the focus of this podcast is like, how can we use research? You know, what do you think this idea that you can have a corrective emotional experience in VOM, like what are the implications for, you know, like how we prepare people to participate in it or how we train mediators? Do you think that there are things that we should be considering that might increase the likelihood that someone will have one?
Yes. I think that across the board, more preparation is needed with both parties in order to maximize the chances of this corrective emotional experience. In a lot of cases, the victim and offender had already sort of done a lot of work on their own before coming in the room. But I had one case that did not go so well. The mediation was terminated after, you know, several hours of it being in stalemate. And then the offender ended up leaving the country rather than doing his restitution, which was an apology letter. And there were parts of the victim that felt that he had been re-victimized by the process. He certainly did not get the corrective emotional experience. And I think that with better prep, either that offender would have been deemed inappropriate for restorative interventions, or that offender could have like had empathy cultivated a little more effectively, because I think that that's important. Like I have found that the corrective emotional experience is an important part. It's not necessary, but it's important. Yeah. You can have a positive outcome without it. But it's a really nice thing to have. Yeah. I think that when you have a corrective emotional experience, I would imagine it's hard to have a bad outcome when you also have a corrective emotional experience.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily want us to speculate about how mediator training could be different, because, you know, we are taking a concept that those of us who provide psychotherapy are generally trained to recognize, foster, promote, right? So I don't want to automatically say that mediators should be expected to do that. But I do think it has also implications for how we train mediators, even in the sense of being able to recognize it or foster it where they can.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing that just occurred to me is that often the people doing the prep work are not the mediators, they're the case manager.
I did not. So can you explain the difference between the case manager and the mediator for those who may not be familiar?
Yeah. So the case manager is someone who like gets the the first referral sheet from the courts, gets assigned the case, is tasked with calling both parties and saying, hey, do you still want to participate? And then the mediator doesn't meet either party until the day of the mediation. And I'm almost wondering if the case manager and the mediator should be the same person, like, because that is more relational, to have some kind of continuity. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting material for future study, I suppose.
Well, I think there's also, you could argue, an advantage to the mediator not having met anyone before, because it also demonstrates their neutrality.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, well, I would be interested
in questions here.
I know. Yeah, if I wanted to do more research, there would be lots of interesting things.
You know, before we begin to wrap up, I just wanted to also, you know, say, like, do you have any other ways that you think, you know, your dissertation can be used or, like, change the way we approach things or change the way that we think about things within this area?
Yeah, I hope that people read, well, I hope people read my dissertation, period, but I hope they read it and are struck by how open both parties were in a lot of the instances.
Mm-hmm.
There were crimes that had significant emotional impact, and the victim had done some mental gymnastics and had arrived there feeling like they wanted to give a gift to the offenders. And I think that the participants in my study taught me a lot about resilience and forgiveness, which is truly why I work in forensics anyway. That's what I'm constantly learning about from my clients, is resilience and forgiveness. And I hope that people read anything in the forensic world, but especially qualitative forensic research, and think, huh, these people aren't the way I thought they were. You know, I think challenging assumptions is important. I also really want there to be more qualitative forensic research. Quantitative research is fantastic. We need it. But qualitative complements it really well. I want forensic stories to be out there more because they're important.
Yeah. Fantastic. And, you know, we will have a link to your dissertation in the show notes. And the citation to the one paper that's already been accepted. I know another one is under review. So the people can read it. Thank you for so much just for taking the time to unpack all of these findings that you had over these two episodes. So helpful and so interesting, and always so much more research to do if you do change your minds.
Yeah, if anyone wants to do that research, get in touch with Jordan.
Okay, goodbye, Kaylee. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.